Chapter 11. Matins and Lords, Prime, Terce, Sext, Nones, Vespers, and Compline. At each of the canonical hours, and often between them, prayers for a north wind rose from the churches of Kutali, prayers far more fervent than Jack or his advisers had imagined at first. The Kutaliotes loathed and dreaded Ismail Bey, but they loathed and dreaded Mustafa even more. They knew him directly, or by reputation, as an exceedingly violent, cruel man, subject to huge, ungovernable rages, and few of the Greeks had not lost relatives in the burning villages or devastated countryside of the Moria. And it was Mustafa whom they all looked upon as the most likely attacker, he being seaborne and immensely active. One measure of their dread was their kindness to the sailors ashore, and their eager cooperation when it was understood that the officers wished to settle the true line for an enormous rope running from the mole to the citadel, a rope that must necessarily sag, but that must nevertheless have a clear path between its supports. The officer chiefly concerned, Mr. Pullings, or the maiden, as the Kutaliotes called him because of his mild face and gentle manners, had but to hint that a wall, outhouse, chimney, dovecot might be in the way for it to vanish, plucked down if not by its owners, then by his neighbours and the rest of the community. The prayers for a north wind were not answered at once, which was just as well, since it gave Captain Aubrey time to write his dispatch for the Dryad to carry to the Commander-in-Chief, a long and detailed account of his proceedings, together with a request for more marines for the final assault, at least two sloops for diversionary actions, and to prevent reinforcements and supplies being thrown into Marga from Corfu, and for money to enroll three troops of Mirdites and one of Muslim Khegs for 3 weeks at 9 Archiro Castro Piastres a calendar month, they to find themselves in arms and victuals. Jack had little hope of the sloops, but it was thought that he could rely on the money, just as he could be sure that the Dryad would bring back the officers and men of the prize crew, perhaps with news of the Bonhomme Richard's condemnation and sale, and with any letters from home that might have arrived in their absence. It also allowed time for his furious quarrel with Professor Graham, not indeed to die away, nor yet to be composed, since each maintained his original position, but at least to reach a stage where they could disagree with the outward appearance of civility. The quarrel had begun at Sirehand's table, when Graham choked over his stuffed vine leaves on hearing Jack say, "Very well, I shall send for the guns." "But for that vile, pragmatical Moldavian dragoman, those words would never have been conveyed," he cried as soon as they were alone. "I should have refused to interpret such an extreme indiscretion." An angry, loud-breathing pause, and he burst out, "You had all the advantages a negotiator could desire, and without consultation, nay, apparently without the least reflection, you took it upon yourself to throw them away. Throw them away!" He developed his theme at considerable length. Even if Captain Aubrey had not seen fit to consult with his advisers on the attitude to be adopted to Sihan Bey, he must surely have seen that he was in a position to insist upon the most favourable terms. Before committing himself in any way, he could have required a detailed agreement, a properly established treaty with security for the observation of its terms. The Bey would certainly have given one of his nephews as a hostage, and the various Kutaliote communities would have done the same. In all negotiation, and a fortiori, all Oriental negotiation, each side was expected to extract all possible profit from the balance of forces. If either side did not do so, it was because there was some hidden weakness. A plain, unconditional acquiescence in a demand must necessarily be taken as the greatest proof of weakness. And quite apart from the hostages and the guarantees for the free use of the port, there were innumerable other aspects that should have been gone into before any agreement was reached. For example, Sihan and his advisers, who were intelligent men, accustomed to business, would undoubtedly have examined the possibility of disarming Mustafa by offering him compensation for the loss of Kutali in the form of a share of the territory of Marga, to be acquired by both Sihan and Mustafa according to the terms of an offensive and defensive alliance that would also strengthen both against Ismail. Fortunately, it was not too late. Captain Aubrey's ill-judged remark was in no way binding. It could be explained as a mere feast-time formula of politeness, and the real negotiations could begin between the advisers on both sides. Jack replied coldly that he regarded his words as wholly binding, that he was convinced that he and Sihan understood one another, and that in any event the responsibility lay with the captain of the Surprise. That was the last cool remark in the discussion, which presently grew not only warm but even personal. Graham wished to hear no more of this parrot cry of responsibility. If an invaluable opportunity was lost to the country through frowardness and ignorance, it was of little or no comfort to an injured public to fasten the responsibility upon some particular one of its servants. It was the duty of those engaged in warfare, and above all in the political side of warfare, to consider the situation with the impartiality of a natural philosopher watching the action of spirits of salt upon hartshorn, of the electric fluid on a dead frog's thigh. All sentiment and personal preference must be laid aside, and other purely objective and informed opinion must be sought. Throughout this inauspicious day, however, Captain Aubrey had been clearly guided by his personal likes and dislikes, and by the fact that these people called themselves Christians. He had made up his mind on sentimental grounds. This had been evident from the moment they set foot on shore until the moment they left, and it was of no use for Captain Aubrey to prate about respect and discipline. Professor Graham was not one of Captain Aubrey's subordinates. The cruel and bloody lash which he had seen, with bitter regret, so disgracefully used upon this very ship, was not for him. And even if he were a subordinate, that would not prevent him from doing his duty or protesting, officially and with the utmost vehemence, against this ill-considered course of action. Nor was it of any use for Captain Aubrey to look big and talk loud. Professor Graham was not a man to be bullied. If, like some other military forms of life, Captain Aubrey was a being that confused superior force with superior reason, that was Captain Aubrey's affair. Nothing would prevent Professor Graham from telling the truth, calmly and without raising his voice. Volume of sound was in no way related to volume of veracity. Captain Aubrey might speak violently if he chose. It made no difference to the truth. If Captain Aubrey were to turn his cannon, the Ultima Ratio Regum, and of other bullies, on Professor Graham, the truth would remain unaltered. No, said Professor Graham, now quite hoarse from bellowing, he did not suppose that he possessed a monopoly of wisdom. The remark he might observe in passing was wholly irrelevant and as illiberal as if Professor Graham had referred to Captain Aubrey's remarkable bulk, or to his lack of education. But in this particular case, an impartial observer, comparing Professor Graham's not inconsiderable knowledge of Turkish history, language, literature, policy, and customs, with the encyclopedic ignorance and presumption of those who contradicted him, might be tempted to think so. Furthermore, at this juncture, Stephen broke in, and maintained a rapid, vapid flow of talk, refusing to be interrupted until the blessed beating of the drum enabled him to lead Graham away undefeated to the gunroom, where amidst a silent consternation, for both gentlemen had been tolerably audible, the cabin bulkheads being not much above ordinary matchboarding in thickness, whereas even 9-inch plank would scarcely have sufficed to keep so passionate a disagreement in, he savagely dismembered a pair of Kutaliot fowls. In the course of this disagreement, Jack had suffered from his usual want of eloquence. Well-chosen words came fairly pouring out of Graham, and from the fact that he had not had the support he expected from Stephen.
"I really think you might have stood up for me a little more," he said. "I should have taken it friendly, was you to have flashed out a piece of Latin or Greek when he checked me with my bulk."
"Well, brother, you had already let fall some remarks about meagre, wizened bookworms. By that time you were both calling names, which is the end of all discourse. Earlier, when you were conversing like Christians rather than roaring like Turks, I did not intervene because I thought there was substance in Graham's contention."
"Do you think I did wrong? In negotiations of this kind, and with men like Sirhan, the natural spontaneous word may do better than any amount of tortuous haggling and formal treaties."
"I think you should have consulted Graham beforehand. He is, after all, an eminent authority on Turkish affairs, and you have wounded him extremely by not doing so. And I think he may have been right about Mustafa. The more I hear of the Capitan Bey, and the more I reflect upon the situation, the more I am persuaded that he is less concerned with the possession of Kutali than with keeping Ismail out of it, and more generally with doing Ismail in the eye, as the seamen say. I hear accounts of his obsessive hatred for the man on all hands, and I think that if you had not committed yourself so thoroughly to Sirhan, you might have been wise to take this into account. After all, it may be held that in war there is neither Turk, nor Christian, nor moral consideration."
"A war like that would not be worth fighting," said Jack.
"And yet the deer knows war is not a game," said Stephen.
"No," said Jack. Perhaps I should have said, not worth winning.
The breeze came northerly. The Dryad sailed for Cephalonia and Malta. The bay clapped an embargo on all shipping so that the news should not reach Marga before the first cannonball and the first summons to surrender, and the surprises set about rigging their ropeway. At one point they had hopes of completing it by the time the transports could be expected from Cephalonia, 4 or 5 days with the usual variable breezes at this season of the year, but it was soon found that their first plan had been too sanguine, and that at least a week would be necessary, since the Kutaliot's goodwill did not extend to the destruction of 3 particularly valued church towers and a raised cemetery in which the dead lay as though in pigeonholes, and the only way of avoiding them was to start right over at the far corner of the mole, a much more considerable undertaking. However, they made a vigorous beginning, the merchants and shipowners of Kutali coming forward with massive windlasses and great quantities of cordage, though nothing that the navy could possibly look upon in the light of a cable, and presently the system took on its general form, with light hawsers running by stages from bottom to top. This was only a beginning, of course. True cables, 17-inch cables, 120 fathoms long apiece, spliced end to end and heaved as near twanging tight as human ingenuity could heave them, were to take the hawsers' place. But just as the prayers of the Catholic Albanians, Orthodox Greeks, and the various minorities, such as Melkites, Copts, Jews, and Nestorians, for a north wind had been immoderate, so was the response. The north wind came, but although it carried the Dryad racing down to Cephalonia, it also kept the transports pinned there, and quite soon it worked up such a heavy sea that it was impossible to stay on that exposed corner of the mole. Pullings, the boatswain, and their men were obliged to confine themselves to fine work at the top or on the intermediate stages, walking up and down the sunny town day after day, growing thoroughly familiar with its geography and its people, talking to them in fearless naval Albanian or Greek, or even both. At the beginning, Jack divided his time between the ropeway and the road the chosen guns would have to take to batter Marga. He also took his gunner and the marine officer to consider sites for the batteries, but it was thought unwise to spend much time up there for fear of arousing suspicion, and he was happy to accept Siahan Bay's invitation to hunt the wolf. He took his sickly midshipman Williamson with him, feeling that the boy could do with an airing, and he adjured him to keep close to the bay's nephews, who would show him what to do, and perhaps keep him from being eaten by the quarry. They had a pleasant day of it, but for the fact that Jack's horse, though of the famous Epirotic breed, was not up to its rider's weight. Towards the evening the wolf retired to a dank forest, the haunt of many of its kind, and here, in a clearing, the horse refused to go any farther. They were alone, the bay, his nephews, Mr. Williamson, and the mixed bag of dogs having vanished among the trees some time ago, and as Jack sat there on his trembling, sweating mount in the twilight, he realized that persuasion would be useless. The horse could do no more. He dismounted and heard it gasp with relief. He looped the reins over his arm and they walked quietly back, meaning to leave the forest where they had first entered it, at a grassy place by a brook. From time to time the horse looked into his face with its lustrous and, for a horse, intelligent eyes, as though to express something, possibly doubt, for the darkness gathered under the trees and the grassy place did not appear. Then, while Jack was considering what little sky he could see through the leaves to get his bearings, they heard a wolf's voice away on the right, and another beyond it. The horse at once began to dance, thoroughly revived by now, and although Jack had it firmly by the head, he could not mount. They spun round one another faster and faster, until he managed to thrust its rump against a tree, which gave him just enough time to make a frog-like spring, swarm into the saddle, and away. When he had recovered both stirrups, a long process, and something like control, they were out of the trees, labouring up a ferny slope, the horse's ears brought to bear on a dimly seen dell right ahead. Again the cry of wolves to the left and the right, and now from the very dell itself, followed almost immediately afterwards by the hail, "Captain Aubrey, ahoy!" He distinguished Williamson and one of the bay's younger nephews against the skyline as they emerged from the dell. They howled again, coming down to meet him, and he said, "Why are you making that goddamn row, youngster?" "We are imitating the wolves, sir. Suleiman here can do it so well they answer almost every time. Ain't it fun? How the other chaps will envy us!"
Stephen also had some modest fun while the North Wind kept the guns in Cephalonia. In his life he had never seen a spotted eagle. He longed to see a spotted eagle, and since this was a country in which spotted eagles might reasonably be expected to be seen, he made his wishes known. Father Andros knew nothing about eagles, spotted or plain, but there was a family of shepherds behind Vostitsa who were said to know everything about birds, how to call and how to speak to them by name. They collected nestling falcons and trained them up for hawking. The mother of these young men, on being called, asserted that she knew the spotted eagle well, intimately well, that her husband had frequently pointed it out when they were in the mountains together, and that her boys would certainly find the gentleman a very spotted one. Stephen believed in her goodwill, but little else. She had agreed with every description he proposed, and in her desire to please the priest, she would in all likelihood have promised him a cassowary. It was with no great expectations, therefore, that he set out on his 17-mile ride into the mountains. But it was in a state of singular happiness and contained satisfaction that he came staggering, stiff and bandy-legged, into the cabin and said, "Jack, give me joy! I have seen 5 spotted eagles, 2 old and 3 young!" Professor Graham, on the other hand, spent his days in conference with the Mirdite bishop, Father Andros, and other Christian leaders, with the Bey's Turkish councillors, and with certain travelling government officials, old acquaintances from his days in Constantinople. When he was speaking Turkish or Greek, his schoolmasterly arrogance tended to drop away. He was a more amiable man and a more efficient intelligence agent, and during this period he gathered a surprising amount of information about Ismail's relations with the French, the various complex treacheries of the inland pashas, the Egyptian viceroy's appeal to the English to support him in a revolt against the Sultan, and the history of the friendship, the quarrel, and the reconciliation between Mustafa and Ali Pasha of Yanina. All this he summarized for Stephen's benefit, for although, as he said, his advice might be neither required nor regarded, he still had a conscience, and it was possible that Dr. M.'s voice might be heard when his was not. Graham was able to devote a long time to this task, far longer than he had expected, for although the heavy sea died down, allowing the work on the mole to continue, the wind remained obstinately in the north. And in fact, the ropeway was complete before they had even so much as a smell of the transports. The entire midshipmen's berth and all the ship's boys had, on one pretext or another, walked, crawled, and finally climbed the whole majestic catenary curve from bottom to top. And 1 32-pounder carronade and 1 long 12-pounder had already made the trial voyage successfully there and back. In a word, everything was ready, except for the essential cannon, and spies sent into Marga by the mountain paths reported that no one there had the least notion of an attack. But still the north wind blew. Day after day the north wind blew. And it was now, when the waiting time was growing not only tedious but barely tolerable, when the time was full ripe, and perhaps on the turn to rotten ripe, and when Jack was haunted by the feeling that the excellent beginning was in extreme danger, if for no other reason than that the news must leak out, and the effect of surprise be lost, for with Sirhan's embargo the busy port was becoming more and more crowded with shipping, and the cause must soon be evident— It was now, when he and Stephen were sitting in the cabin, silent between 2 pieces of music as the frigate lay rocking gently alongside Kutale Mole, that Graham came aboard, unusually late at night. They heard the sentry's challenge. They heard Graham's habitually harsh and ungracious reply, and some moments later Killick came in to say that the professor would like to see the captain.
"I have this to report, sir," said he in a cold, formal tone. "There is a rumour in the Turkish camp that Ismail has been appointed governor of Kotali, and that the Sultan has signed the Irade, and that the document has already reached Nicopolis."
The thought,
"Oh my God, I've backed the wrong man,"
flashed through Jack's mind, together with a whole train of other bitter reflections, as he laid his fiddle on the locker.
"How much truth is there in it, do you think?"
he asked.
"I do not know," said Graham. "It would be unusual for the port to come to a decision so soon in a matter of this kind. But on the other hand, our embassy has been very busy, I'm afraid. Perhaps fatally busy."
"Why do you say fatally busy?"
"Because if Ismail is installed, that is the end of our attack on Marga. As Dr. Maturin may have told you, I have undeniable evidence of his relations with the French. They are a source of very great profit to him."
"Do you know the origin of the rumour?"
The most probable origin is a courier who passed through on his way to Ali Pasha. The account may be exaggerated, but it is likely to have some foundation. A man would have little temptation to invent such unwelcome news.
If it is true, what do you think we should do?
Are you asking my advice, sir?
Yes, I am.
I cannot give you a considered reply. I have only caught a fag end of the tale at third hand, no doubt distorted. I must see the bay in the morning. Fortunately, he is an early riser.
The old Turk walked out of his kiosk to mount his horse before dawn. But he did not outrise Captain Aubrey, for Jack had not gone to bed at all. Much of the night he spent on deck, watching the clouds scud from the north as he paced up and down, irritating the harbour watch and absolutely terrifying Mowat as he crept back from a venereal assignation. And as he paced so, some critic in his mind kept up a very unprofitable nagging about what he ought to have done, outlining various courses that would infallibly have led to success. He ought, for example, to have closed with Mustafa right away and to have sent for the transports by that same tide. The wind would then have served admirably, Mustafa would have taken Kutali out of hand, and by now they would be battering Marga together. For the Capitan Bey, though something of an explosive and unpredictable ruffian, was at least a man of action. Nonsense, he replied. Kutali would have had to be conquered street by street, if it had been conquered at all, even with the guns destroying its walls and houses, and Mustafa was quite untrustworthy as far as Marga was concerned. When he had had enough, and more than enough, of this nagging, Jack went below, and having stared for some time at charts of the passage north from Cephalonia, charts he knew by heart, he turned to his unfinished letter home.
"So much, my dear, for the public side, the service side, for the lost time and opportunity and treasure if all this turns out to be true," he wrote. "Now, since we are the same person, I can speak of the personal side. If the expedition returns to Malta, with its cargo of guns having accomplished nothing, Hart's expressions of goodwill and support will not amount to much. They will certainly not prevent him from tossing me over the side. He can say that I backed the wrong man, and I cannot deny it. The responsibility and the blame will rest on me, and no amount of justification on my part, though I could produce a great deal, will make a scrap of difference to the outcome. With ill will it could be made to look very bad indeed, and even with a friendly report, which I cannot expect, it must be a very black mark against my name. And that, coming after the fiasco at Medina, will do me no good at all in Whitehall. What particularly grieves me is that it will put it even farther out of my power to do anything for Tom Pullings. If he is ever to be promoted commander, and employed in that rank, it must be tolerably soon, for no one wants a greybeard in a sloop of war, nor even a man of 35. Yet on the other hand, I now know that the people of Kutali would have resisted Mustafa, however much he had battered their walls. And when I think what his men would have done in the town, I am glad I had no hand in it."
His thoughts moved on to Andrew Ray, to the unholy alliance between Hart and Ray, to the large number of influential men he had contrived to disoblige in one way or another, to his father. Eight bells, and piercing through his reflections came the shrill piping of all hands at the main hatchway, and the muffled bellowing of boatswain's mates.
"Starbullens hoy! Starbullens hey! Rise and shine there, rise and shine! Here I come with a sharp knife and a clear conscience! Ah, rise and shine, out or down! Tumble up, you idle hounds!"
And a remote howl of laughter as Sleeper Parslow's hammock was in fact cut down. Eight bells and Killick removed the daylights from the stern window, admitting a grey morning, and peering in himself with an inquisitive expression on his rat-like face. Inquisitive and rat-like, certainly, but also shining with cleanliness. How he did it Jack could not tell, remembering his own days on the lower deck and the total absence of anything to wash in before the forenoon watch, and precious little then. Clean and benevolent today, since it was evident that Jack was low in his spirits. For Killick was not unlike a partner on a seesaw, often being at his most shrewish when Jack's cheerfulness was at its height, and the other way about. He reported the wind, still north-northeast, and the weather, medium fair, and then went to fetch the coffee.
"Professor's gone ashore, sir," he said in a conversational tone, bringing it in. "Most uncommon early."
"Is he?"
said Jack.
"I shall look forward to seeing him when he returns. Let me know the moment he comes aboard."
After a long, blank interval in which the decks were cleaned with the usual din of holy stones and swabs and sluicing water, and hammocks were piped up to the sound of a furious rush of more than 200 men, many of them shouting, a stampede repeated almost immediately afterwards as the same horde was piped to breakfast, Stephen came in, and they waited for Graham together, eating buttered toast without the slightest appetite.
"At least," said Jack, "the glass is beginning to fall."
"What does that signify?"
"A change of weather, with the wind almost certainly coming easterly, or even south of east. Lord, how I hope so. Even a few points east would bring the transports up. I know Venable and Allen are both keen, enterprising men, and I am sure they would sail the moment they possibly could. It is not much above 2 days' sailing, with a brisk full topsail breeze, even 1 point free. Good morning, Tom," he said, looking up in surprise. "Sit down and take a bite."
"I beg pardon for bursting in like this, sir," said Pullings, "but I'm just come from the mole and the works, and the town is all of a screech. As far as I can make out, that Ismail is to be governor, and they want us to land guns to protect them from him. There is a party coming to see you, sir. They're in such a pitiful taking, I said I was sure you would receive them."
"Oh, Christ, Pullings," began Jack,
but it was too late. The party was aboard, and nothing would keep them out. They were mostly priests of the different denominations, though Father Andros was not there, but some were laymen, middle-aged or elderly merchants, senators in the time of the Republic, and they put it to Captain Aubrey that it was his duty to protect his fellow Christians, to guarantee, if not the independence, then at least the privileged status of Kutali. The city was Turkish, nominally Turkish, rather than part of the Republic of the Seven Islands, only by an error that the powers would soon put right. Jack said that he was no more than an officer acting under orders. He could not commit his admiral, far less his king's government. They explained Kutali's special position, a position that had been guaranteed in the first place by their possession of the citadel, and that had been respected by Sayahan Bey. Ismail would not respect it, and the citadel was now known to be naked, an empty threat. 20 guns, no more, would enable them to impose terms on Ismail. They were very urgent with Captain Aubrey to send at least his upper-deck cannon to the citadel and repay himself from the transports, which must arrive very soon now. One of the former senators, a shipowner and a man of great experience, said that down off Cephalonia the wind would already be in the east. With this cloud formation he had known it again and again. Jack said that what they asked him was impossible. This ship and everything in her belonged to his master. They then described to him the taking of a Christian city by Turkish troops, particularly by the irregulars, the utterly undisciplined Bashibazooks employed by Ismail. Murder, of course, with women raped and men and children sodomized, but also monstrous desecration of churches, graves, and everything holy. It was extremely painful. It was as painful as anything Jack had ever known, to have elderly, dignified men kneeling to him there in the great cabin.
"Gentlemen, gentlemen," cried Stephen, "we are running too far ahead entirely. All this is no more than a rumour, mere words blowing in the wind. Let me implore you, before you take any desperate measures, even any measures at all that might give the Turks just cause for resentment, to wait on Sayahan Bey to learn where the truth lies and what steps he intends to take."
"Have you ever known an evil rumour that was not true?" asked a tall, white-bearded man.
"God help them, poor people, poor people," muttered Jack, watching them cross the gangway. And aloud he said, "Mr. Gill, let the ship be warped out a cable's length into the fairway."
For women, veiled or shawled, were gathering fast on the mole, and he could not bear their coming aboard to plead with him. The hands who carried out the cage and who cast off the moorings knew very well what they were about, and they and their officers and their captain looked mean, hangdog, and ashamed as the frigate, that powerful battery of guns, edged away from the silent, crowded wharf. It was noon before Graham came back. He was wearing Turkish clothes, looking so natural in them that after a moment neither Jack nor Stephen noticed the odds, and he said,
"I have got to the bottom of it, I believe. I have reached the underlying truth. The position seems to be this. The Sarfetim, a kind of preliminary appointment, has been made out in Ismail's favour, but the Sultan has not signed the Irade, and no Irade has reached Nicopolis or anywhere else.
"'The Tsar Fetim may have done so, since it is not unusual to send these announcements to the regions concerned to see how they are received. There is some slight analogy with the banns of marriage. I propose riding post to Constantinople to put the case before the embassy. When I confront them with the proof of Ismail's intimate connection with the French, I have no doubt that they will not only withdraw their support, but press for the revocation of the Tsar Fetim. Furthermore, both Sayahan and the Kutaliots have given me drafts for a sum of money that should certainly ensure this revocation, and almost certainly the eventual appointment of Sayahan. They have also supplied me with a guard of Albanian horses.
"'You relieve my mind extremely, Professor,' said Jack. "'We may carry out our attack on Marga yet.'
"'I hope so, I am sure,' said Graham. "'But Sayahan has some lingering superstitious doubts about the Irade, and in any case, without risking the bowstring, he cannot move until the Tsar Fetim is withdrawn. Once that is settled, however, he says he will certainly carry out his part of the agreement, and by then the guns are more likely to be here.
"'With the wind as it lies, I believe we may look for them the day after tomorrow,' said Jack. "'But tell me, Professor, is not this a most prodigious, wearisome ride you are undertaking? Should you not prefer one of these fine, taut caiques?' They can sail wonderfully close to the wind, and I have known them log 200 miles from one noon observation to the next, and this breeze serves for up or down.
No doubt, said Graham, but the sea is an uncertain, chancy, whimsical, female, lunar element. You advance 1 mile upon its surface, and at the same time the whole body of water has retired a league. I prefer the honest earth, where my advance is absolute, however arduous. And I am no more a seaman than is a Turk or a Tibcat. Now, gentlemen, have you any commands for Constantinople? If not, I must beg to take my leave.
Stephen accompanied him to the shore, and as they walked to the Maidan, where the horses were waiting, Graham said,
I shall go by Yanina, where Ali Pasha will tell me how things stand at the palace, and where I shall have a conference with his Christian Greek advisers and with Osman the Smyrniot, who knows a great deal about the workings of the port. He was the author of the Pera reports that you admired so much.
You are well with Ali Pasha?
I was able to do him a kindness once, and though he is a man of blood, he is not ungrateful. He will offer me a large guard, but I shall not take it.
Why is this, colleague?
Because Ali is strongly suspected of disloyalty, of wishing to set up as an independent ruler, as so many pashas have done or tried to do, and if only he could be rid of Mustafa, who is in a position to hinder him by sea, I am convinced he would do that very thing. So the less I am seen with him or his men, the better. Here are my kegs. Good day to you, Maturin.
It was Captain Aubrey's intention to put to sea until the probable time of Graham's return, to gather his transports on their way north, and with them to look into Paxo and Corfu, and other places held by the French, partly to harass the enemy if the opportunity offered, and partly because so long a stay in such a welcoming port was bad for the ship's health and discipline, but far, far more, because an even longer stay must make the French commander in Marga uneasy. For embargo or no embargo, news spread in this country, as it were, by the wind alone, and Father Andros, putting off with the present of a buck from Sayahan, told him that various versions of the rumour about Ismail were already to be heard in the remotest mountain villages. Yet Captain Aubrey, his first lieutenant, and above all his boatswain, were extremely unwilling to put to sea with so many of their cables, and those her best, stretched between the mole and the citadel. A ship often needed to veer out a great scope of cable if it came on to blow, two or even three on end, and proper simpletons they would look, dragging their anchors on a lee shore, having left half a mile of prime 17-inch stuff behind them dangling on a mountainside. On the other hand, although the people of Kutali were a little less agitated than they had been at first, there were still continual processions to the churches, and Jack hesitated to give the word to unrig the ropeway. It was not usual for him to discuss his orders with anyone, since in his opinion a ship, and above all a man of war, was not
a goddamn debating society, nor yet an infernal House of Commons.
But on this occasion he said privately to Pullings,
"What do you think about it, Tom?"
"I think there would be a riot, sir," said Pullings. "They would be sure we were deserting them. I know if I touched so much as a limmer line, Annie would have a fit of the mother."
"Who is Annie?"
asked Jack. "Oh, sir," cried Pullings, blushing crimson, "she is only a young person where I go to have a cup of coffee sometimes, a very small cup of coffee, and to learn a little of the language, the customs of the country." Stephen asked Father Andros his opinion, and Father Andros, having pulled his beard and looked anxious for a while, admitted that it might be better to wait for a day or two, while the people grew accustomed to the notion that their fears had been exaggerated, that matters were likely to be arranged satisfactorily, and that the ship's going was not definitive.
"One can do a great deal with rumour, with word of mouth properly employed," he said, with a look that surprised Stephen. "If you had asked me, I should have put it in hand earlier."
Very late on Friday night, therefore, the Surprise was lying at single anchor, riding easy with her head to the moderate southeast wind, and hoping to get her cables in next morning, and her captain and surgeon were sawing away fortissimo, building up to the climax of their Corelli in C major, when the door burst open and Graham appeared in the opening. His appearance was so extraordinary that neither said a word, but merely stared. The sound fled out of the room, and he cried,
"Mustafa is at sea. He has taken the transports. You may catch him if you're quick."
"Where away?" asked Jack.
"He is taking them into Antipaxo, and from there he goes straight on to meet Ali Pasha at Makini, sailing at dawn."
Jack strode across the great cabin, through the fore cabin, and whipped up the quarterdeck ladder in the darkness. He was strongly tempted to slip the cable, but the notion of putting to sea with almost nothing to hold him to the seabed was so abhorrent, so against all his feelings of what was right, so nearly impious, that he changed his order to
"All hands to way!"
And by the time he left the deck, the capstan bars were already being swifted, and the barrel had already made a preliminary turn or so, with the musical click of the pawls. Three top lanterns and a few battle lanterns on deck and between decks were all they had to see by, but it was wonderful how a really seasoned crew of man-of-war's men worked together, rapidly, accurately, with little noise and no fuss, although half of them had been asleep in their hammocks not 5 minutes before. When he returned to the cabin, Stephen was easing Graham's boots off and mopping the places where they had chafed him raw.
"You have had a hard ride of it, Professor," he said. "Where have you come from?"
"Only Yanina."
"That is far enough, in all conscience. Should you not take a glass of brandy, perhaps, and then something to eat? Killick, killick there!"
"You are very good, if I might be indulged in a little cocoa with milk and a lightly boiled egg, but they are already preparing."
"When you have recovered a little, you must tell us how Mustafa came to do this extraordinary thing."
The cocoa came in, but Graham's hands were trembling so that he could scarcely drink from the mug. However, the ship was on an even keel, so he put it down on Diana's music stand and drank by suction.
"That's a braw whet," he said, holding out his mug for more. "I will tell you now. Mustafa is in open rebellion. He has thrown off his allegiance to the Sultan and has raised his own standard. He needed the guns, and so he has taken them."
"Was there an action? Has he hurt many of our people?"
"No, he decoyed them in. He is treating them well in hopes of an arrangement."
"And his course is from Antipaxo to Makeni, sailing at dawn? You are sure of that?"
"As sure as I can be of anything in this world of false seeming," said Graham. "He has a rendezvous with Ali Pasha at Makeni tomorrow evening, and he goes there in his ship, the Torgud."
"Forgive me a moment," said Jack.
On deck, the capstan was turning steadily, the ship gliding across the quiet, black water, and as Jack turned into the master's day cabin calling for a light, he heard the boatswain on the forecastle cry,
"Right up and down, sir,"
and Pullings reply,
"Thick and dry for weighing."
He studied the charts by the flaring lamp. Antipaxo to Makeni. The wind steady at southeast, a t'gallant breeze. He laid off Mustafa's course, and another to intercept it in the approaches to the Corfu Channel, where the narrowing of the shores must correct even the wildest Turkish navigation. He worked it out twice, with the known performance of both ships, and it appeared to him that they could scarcely fail to meet. Mr. Gill, yawning and unshaved, but quick, keen, and accurate with figures nevertheless, came to the same conclusion independently. Turning the course over in his mind, Jack walked forward to see the anchor catted, and as he stood there he caught the ship's mood, eager excitement at the prospect of a dust-up, intense curiosity about their opponent, and a lively anticipation of orders for a middle watcher,
that uncovenanted refreshment that some of the humaner captains, Aubrey among them, sometimes called for when all hands had been turned up, particularly from harbour watch, at a more ungodly hour than usual. He walked back along the starboard gangway, watching the few remaining lights of Kutali glide slowly astern. And reaching the quarter-deck, he said to the officer of the watch,
"Due north to clear the headland. Give it a wide berth, Mr. Mowat, I beg. And when we are clear west by south a half-west, topsails and jib."
"Due north, and a wide berth it is, sir. Then west by south and a half-west, topsails and jib."
Professor Graham was sitting in front of his uneaten eggs, an unbitten piece of bread and butter in his hand. He looked old, surprisingly frail, unwell.
"Now, sir," said Jack to him, "we are heading out to sea. If your information about Mustafa is correct, and if the breeze holds steady, we may hope to meet him some time in the afternoon tomorrow."
"I believe it is correct," said Graham. "Let me tell you the circumstances."
An expectant silence, with only the sound of the ship gathering way, the gentle creaking of innumerable ropes, blocks, and spars, and the run of water along her side, the more and more urgent heel as her sails were braced to take the wind. Then he said,
"I am too worn and stupid to give you anything but the boldest account, and I may leave out some important points. Well now, the whole tale of Ismail was a flam, a piece of deception invented and engineered by Ali Pasha. It deceived the whole countryside. It deceived me, I am ashamed to say. And it deceived Mustafa, which was the whole object."
"Why Mustafa?"
"To push him over the edge into rebellion. He was very near it in any case. The news of Ismail's success was perfectly intolerable, and it threw Mustafa into a frenzy of rage and jealousy. And Ali had a confidential friend there to spur him on. He and Ali would join forces and divide the western provinces, and to urge him to make the first bold stroke immediately, seizing the transports while they were within his reach, and then coming on to confer with Ali for their campaign against Ismail."
"What were Ali's motives?"
"He means to rebel himself. A loyal Mustafa was one of the few men who could stand in his way. If Ali sends Mustafa's head to Constantinople, that not only does away with the suspicions about his fidelity to the Sultan, but also leaves the field quite clear. Besides, there was an old enmity between them, more or less patched up, but never forgotten by Ali Pasha."
"So Ali means to take his head off at their conference?"
"Yes, if Mustafa ever reaches it. But I think Ali really expects you to deal with the situation first, while he contents himself with confiscating Mustafa's treasure, harem, and beylik in the Sultan's name. That is why his councillors gave me such very precise information about Mustafa's movements."
"It is hardly believable,"
Graham said.
"No. No," in a vague, unmeaning voice, and then begged to be excused. He could say no more.
For the 10,000th time, Jack woke to the sound of holy stones on deck. The surprise might be going into action later in the day, but she was certainly going into it titivated to the nines, and the First Lieutenant could be heard calling with unusual insistence for the removal of three spots of tar. Jack's whole massive form was utterly relaxed, yielding to the slow, easy lift and roll. He had been on deck twice during the graveyard watch, but since then he had had some hours of deep, deep velvet sleep, and he felt perfectly rested, actively and positively well. The tension of that interminable waiting for the transports was gone, and with it his uncertainty and his immediate distress about Kutali and all the falsity and double-dealing on shore. His present course of action was clear-cut and perfectly direct at last, an operation that he was fully qualified to undertake by training, inclination, and the splendid instrument at his disposal, and one in which he needed no man's advice. Yet although he had been a great way down, the thought of their probable encounter with a Torgud had never left him. He had fallen asleep, working out the way to her broadside, and now that he was awake his mind carried on the sum. But could the shocking great 36-pounders be counted? Was the renegado to be believed when he said there were only 9 rounds for them altogether? And then what was the Turk's gunnery like? A great deal would depend on that. If it was no better than their seamanship, it would not be very formidable, but the two did not necessarily go together. As for numbers, the Torgud probably had about 150 more men than Surprise when he saw her, but she would have lost a good many in her prize cruise, more than enough to compensate for the Surprises now in Malta or on their way back in the Dryad. He was on the point of exclaiming,
"Thank God a Dryad ain't here,"
for even an unhandy butterbox of her size would upset the fairly even match and take all the glory away, when he realized that nothing could be more presumptuous or unlucky, and choking back even the enunciation of the thought, he sprang out of his cot, singing,
the lily, a rose I lay, the bailey beareth the bell away,
in his powerful, melodious bass. Like a horizontal jack-in-a-box, Killick shot in, carrying shaving water, and lathering away, Jack said to him,
"Britches today, Killick. There are chances we may see action."
With Killick's goodwill, Jack would never have worn anything but scrubbed old nankeen pantaloons and a threadbare coat with the lace taken off, while his good uniforms all lay in tissue paper where no damp or sun could get at them. He now objected to any change on the grounds that a Turk, and above all a rebellious Turk, did not rate breeches.
"Lay out the breeches and top your boom,"
said Jack firmly, when the nagging had been going on for some time. But when he pulled off his nightshirt and turned, he found that although the letter of the order had been obeyed, the spirit, as usual, had not. Before him lay a barely reputable pair of darned breeches, thread stockings, yesterday's shirt, and the coat whose sleeve he had ruined in Ismail's dinner. Of his own authority, he opened a locker and took out the splendid affair he wore to visit admirals, pashas, and governors. In this he walked on to the already crowded quarterdeck, and after a general
"good morning,"
he surveyed the scene. A brilliant day, with a high, dappled sky and the sun a hand's breadth up astern. The breeze steady. The sea flecked with white, where the wind caught the remains of the dying northern swell. From the traverse board and the log board it was clear that the Surprise was almost exactly where he had meant her to be. Cape Doro would lie a little abaft the beam over the starboard horizon, and right ahead Fanari should loom up within an hour or two. He took a couple of turns the whole length of the ship, breathing the sea smell deep in after the closeness of his sleeping cabin, and with it the damp, fresh scent of newly scrubbed planks. Most of the ship's company were on deck, and he moved among faces he knew perfectly well. The men had had their breakfast, and they looked at him cheerfully, knowingly, expectantly, with a certain connivance or complicity. Some were engaged in beautifying the long seams of the larboard gangway with a shining black preparation invented by Mr. Pullings, but most were busy with such things as the breechings of the great guns, or the chipping of round shot to make it more perfectly spherical, truer in its flight, more deadly. The armourer was at his grindstone under the forecastle, with a group of seamen round him relaying one another at the crank and giving advice. He had rows of shining cutlasses and boarding axes and officers' swords at his feet, and his mates were checking pistols by the score, while in a separate body, a little farther aft, the marines, looking quite human in their shirt sleeves, polished their already spotless muskets and bayonets. A couple of turns, and then saying to the officer of the watch,
"Mr. Gill, pray lend me your glass,"
he swung up over the hammocks tightly packed in their netting, and so up and up for the pleasure of climbing, the strong, easy motion of going aloft. The lookout, warned by the creaking of the shrouds, moved out ape-like on the t'gallant yard to make room, and Jack installed himself at the cross-trees. Gazing all round the vast blue disk spread taut below him, and reaching to the sky on every hand. There to starboard lay Cape Doro, where it ought to be within half a point, and he believed he could just make out Fanari ahead.
"Sims,"
he called to the man on the yard,
"keep a good lookout. Do you hear me there? Our gentleman is likely to come up from the south, but since he is a Turk, he might come from anywhere."
With this he returned to the deck, where he found Stephen and Graham. He invited them to breakfast, together with Pullings and two youngsters, Callamy and Williamson, and while it was preparing he talked to the gunner about the amount of cartridge filled, and to the carpenter about the provision of plugs to deal with 40-pound ball shot holes.
"For," he said, "our possible adversary, and I say only possible, Mr. Watson,
or hypothetical, as you might put it, sir."
"Exactly so, is the Torgud, and she carries two Portuguese 36s, which is our 40-pounder, give or take a trifle."
"Hypothetical,"
muttered Killick with great contempt, and then, very aloud, drowning the carpenter's reply,
Whittles is up, sir, if you please.
It was a cheerful meal. Jack was a good host, and when he had time to concern himself with them, he was fond of the little brutes from the midshipmen's berth. Furthermore, he was in remarkably high spirits, and he amused himself and the young gentlemen extremely by dwelling at length on the fact that the country they had just quitted was practically the same as Dalmatia, a mere continuation of Dalmatia, so famous for its spotted dogs. He himself had seen quantities of spotted dogs, had even hunted behind a couple of braces, spotted dogs in a pack of hounds, oh Lord, while the town of Kutali was positively infested with spotted youths and maidens, and now the doctor swore he had seen spotted eagles. Jack laughed until the tears came into his eyes. In a Dalmatian inn, he said, by way of pudding, you could call for spotted dick, give pieces of it to a spotted dog, and throw the remains to the spotted eagles. While the others were enlarging upon the possibilities, Graham said to Stephen in a low voice, "What is the spotted eagle? Is it a duke?"
"The Aquila maculosa, or discolor of some authors, Linnaeus Aquila clanga. The captain is pleased to be arch. He is frequently arch of a morning."
"I beg your pardon, sir," cried the midshipman of the watch, fairly racing in. "Mr. Mark's duty and two sail on the larboard beam, topsails up from the masthead."
"Two?" said Jack. "Are they ships?"
"He cannot make out yet, sir."
"May I go, sir?"
asked Pullings, half out of his chair, his face alive with eagerness.
"I do," said Jack. "We will eat up your bacon for you."
Ships they were. Turkish ships they were, although it was so early, and men of war. The Torgud and the Kitabi. Mustafa had sailed far sooner than had been expected, and being now perhaps less confident of Ali's good faith, he had brought his consort with him.
"Oh, what a damnable thing!" cried Graham,
when this was established beyond the tremor of a doubt.
"Oh, what a bitter, bitter disappointment! Yet I'm sure Osman gave me the best intelligence he had."
He fairly wrung his hands, and Jack said,
"Never be so concerned, sir. It will be somewhat harder, to be sure, but we must not despair of the Republic."
"He cannot possibly attack both of them," said Graham angrily. "The Torgud carries 32 guns in all and nearly 400 men, and the Kitabi 20 guns and 180. You are outnumbered by more than 180. There is no shame in retiring before such odds."
As he said this, some of the people on the quarterdeck nodded. Others adopted reserved, remote expressions. Only Pullings and Mowat frowned with evident disapproval. Stephen thought he detected a predominant sense of agreement with Graham's remark. For his own part, he did not feel qualified to form a naval opinion, but he did know how passionately Jack wished to wipe out the wretched affair at Medina, and he suspected that desire might warp his judgment.
"Why, Professor," said Jack pleasantly, "I believe you are almost in danger of poaching upon my province."
And Graham, recollecting himself, begged pardon and withdrew. Leaning over the hammocks in the starboard netting, Jack watched them over the sparkling sea. The frigate and the 20-gun ship were now not much above 2 miles away, keeping steadily to their original course under all plain sail, while the Surprise stood towards them on the larboard tack, the southeast wind 1.3.
"Lord, how glad I am we weighed directly," he said to himself.
He smiled at the thought of his mad frustration had they arrived too late, all for the sake of the cables and hawsers ashore. He smiled, and even chuckled aloud. By now the quarterdeck had all its officers and young gentlemen, all its proper foremast hands, signalmen, messengers and timoneers, together with everyone else in the ship who had a right to walk upon it, and Stephen and Professor Graham were wedged against the hanses behind the captain's clerk and the purser.
"That seems an uncouth long wait before anything happens," said Graham in a low voice. "I dare say you have seen many actions at sea."
"I have seen the beginnings of several," said Stephen, "but as soon as it grows dangerous, I retire to a place of safety below."
"You are all very arch and jocose this morning," said Graham discontentedly.
Then nodding towards the other side, where Jack and Pullings were discussing some point of their approach and laughing heartily as they did so, he said,
"Do you know the word fey that we use in the north?"
"I do not," said Stephen.
He was perfectly well acquainted with the word, but he did not wish to discuss his friend's dangerous high spirits with Graham.
"I am not a superstitious man, but if those gentlemen are married, and if their wives—"
"All hands aft!"
said Jack, and the howling of the calls and the sound of hundreds of feet drowned Graham's words.
"I'm not going to make a speech,"
said Captain Aubrey to his men.
"We know one another too well to go on about duty. Very well. Now, when we were in Medina, I had to tell you not to fire into the enemy first, and since he would not begin, we were obliged to come away without doing anything. Some of you were not quite pleased. This time it will be different. Those two Turkish men of war over there have rebelled against their sultan."
The wrongs of the Sultan of Turkey left the surprises quite unmoved. Their expressions did not change in the slightest degree. They looked attentively at their captain, who continued,
"And what is more, they have taken our transports. So it stands to reason we must knock some sense into their heads and get our prisoners and ships and cannon back. As I dare say you know, they have a good many men in them, so we are not likely to board very soon, but rather hammer them from a distance. You must fire into their hulls, right into their hulls, mind. Fire low and true. Deliberate fire, with post paid on every ball. Mr. Pullings, we may clear for action and beat to quarters."
Very little required doing. All the warrant and petty officers had had plenty of warning, and they had taken their measures. Mr. Holler, for example, had had his puddings and dolphins in the tops these hours past. Killick had already taken Jack's better clothes and possessions below, and Diana's dressing case, horribly ringed and stained by Graham's cocoa, lay in its elaborate double case in the bread-room. All that remained was for the galley fires to be put out, for the carpenters to knock down the bulkheads of Jack's and the master's cabins, and for the gun crews to take possession of the massive brutes that had been Jack's stable companions. And it was done. The various officers reported to Pullings, and Pullings stepped up to Jack, saluted, and said, "A clean sweep fore and aft, sir, if you please."
"Thank you, Mr. Pullings," said Jack.
And they stood there side by side, smiling and looking forward over the starboard bow at the immediate future coming towards them. The surprise was silent, most of her men grave, as they usually were before action. Grave, but not very much concerned, since there were few who had not run down on the enemy like this many times over. On the other hand, not many had run down to quite such odds, and some thought the skipper had bitten off more than he could chew. Most hands knew very well that Medina rankled at his heart, and the few stupid fellows were soon told.
"That is all very fine and large," said William Pole on hearing the news. "All very fine and large, so long as I don't have to pay for it with my skin."
"For shame, Bill Pole," said the rest of the gun team.
The surprise bore down, therefore, under her fighting sails, with her master at the con, her guns run out, powder boys sitting well behind them on their leather cartridge cases, shot garlands full, splinter netting rigged, scuttle butts all along, decks damped and sanded, and wet fear naught screens over the hatches leading to the magazine far below, where the gunner sat among his little deadly kegs. Mowat had the forward division of guns on the main deck. Honey, the senior master's mate, the after division, with midshipmen attending three aside each, the oldsters, that is to say, for Jack kept the boys who had breakfasted with him on the quarter-deck as aide-de-camp. Those marines who were not quartered at the guns lined the gangway, looking particularly trim, their red coats strikingly brilliant against the white hammock-cloths and the now intense blue of the sea in this powerful sunlight. Their lieutenant now stood amidships, with the purser and the captain's clerk, none of them speaking, but all looking steadily forward at the Turks. In this silence, Graham turned to Stephen, who had not yet gone below to his battle station, and close to his ear said,
"What did Mr. Aubrey mean by desiring the men to put post paid on every ball?" "In English law, it is a capital offence to stop His Majesty's mails. By extension, the stopping of any object marked post paid is also mortal. And indeed the man who stops a cannonball is unlikely to survive."
"So it was a joke?"
"Just so."
"A joke at a time like this? Good God forgive us! Such a man would be facetious at his father's burial."
In the last few minutes the ships had approached to within random shot, the Turks on Surprise's starboard bow holding their course without the slightest deviation, with the Kitabi abreast of the Torgud, a quarter of a mile to leeward. Bondon, the captain of the gun, kept the starboard chaser steadily trained on the Torgud's bows, perpetually shifting it with his handspike. They were drawing together at a combined speed of 10 miles an hour, and just before they came to point-blank range, the silence was ripped apart by a great screaming blast of Turkish trumpets, harsh and shrill.
"God, how it lifts your heart," said Jack,
and he gave the orders,
"Colours at the fore and main!"
With his glass he watched the crowded Turkish deck, saw the man at the halyards, followed the flags as they ran up in reply, and on seeing the regular Turkish ensign break out, he reflected,
"He thinks we do not know yet. Perhaps he hopes to slip by. But his guns are manned."
And aloud he called,
"Professor Graham, pray come and stand by me. Mr. Gill, wear round to the starboard tack and lay me within pistol shot of his starboard side."
Now high seamanship showed its splendid powers. The sail trimmer sprang from their guns. Forecourse, staysails, and jibs flashed out. The frigate leapt forward like a spurred horse and made her quick, tight turn, as Jack knew she would do, bringing her larboard guns to bear when the Turks were still expecting her on the other side.
"Shiver the foretopsail,"
called Jack, with his eye on the Torgud's quarterdeck and her burly captain right under his lee.
"Mr. Graham, call out to him that he must surrender directly. Larboard guns, stand by."
Graham shouted loud and clear. Jack saw Mustafa's red beard part in a white gleam as he roared back his answer. A long answer.
"In effect, he refuses," said Graham.
"Fire!"
The surprise's entire broadside went off in a single explosion that shook both ships from truck to keelson, and for a moment deadened the air. And now, in the thick smoke, rolling to leeward over the Torgud, began the great hammering. Red flashes in the gloom, iron crashing into the hulls on either side or howling overhead, an enormous all-pervading din, with ropes parting, blocks falling, jagged pieces of wood struck from the rails, the bulwark, the decks, and whistling across. After their hesitant start, they being caught on the wrong foot, the Turks fired hard and fast, though with no attempt at regularity, and the first shot of their starboard 36-pounder tore a great gap in the hammocks, scored an 18-inch groove in the mainmast, yet extraordinarily killed no men. But if the Torgud was firing pretty well, or at least pretty fast, the Surprise was excelling herself, now that the broadsides were no longer simultaneous, the guns being out of step after the third or fourth discharge, it was hard to be sure. But judging by number 7 just under him, they were achieving something like a round in 70 seconds, while the quarterdeck carronades were doing even better, and Jack was very sure that their aim was a great deal truer than the Turks'. Glancing to windward, he saw a wide area of sea torn up by Turkish grape and round shot that must have missed by as much as 20 or 30 yards, and then as he paced up and down he stared to leeward, trying to pierce the smoke.
"I wonder the Turk bears it so long,"
he said, and as he spoke he saw the Torgud's topsails bracing round as she edged away to join the Kitabi to leeward. He caught the master's eye. Gill nodded. He was already following the movement. After a few minutes of this gradual turn, the smoke would blow away ahead, and the sharpshooters would have a chance. He bent to his youngsters, and shouting loud through the uproar and the general deafness that affected all hands, he said,
"Mr. Callamy, jump up to the tops and tell them to annoy the Turk's 36-pounder. Mr. Williamson, tell Mr. Mert and Mr. Honey we are reducing the charges up here by a third. Mr. Pullings, make it so."
At this furious rate of fire, the guns heated excessively, and they kicked with even greater force when they went off. Indeed, as he moved towards the taffrail, trying to see through the smoke, one of the quarterdeck carronades did in fact break its breeching and overset. As he bent to snub a trailing side-tackle, the waft of the 36-pound ball sweeping over the deck a foot from his head made him stagger. And now, as the iron hail beat furiously on and about the Surprise, ball, grape, and bar flying through the continuous thunder, with a crackle of musketry above it, there was a new note. The Torgud, with the Surprise following her, had edged down much closer to the Kitabi, and now the Kitabi opened with her shrill 12-pounders. Up until this point, the Surprise had not suffered badly, except perhaps in her hull. But this present hail knocked one of the forward guns half across the deck, striking it on its own recoil and maiming three of its crew. And again the 36-pounder roared out. Its great crash was followed by a screaming below that for 2 minutes pierced even the united gunfire. And now a bloody trail on the deck showed where the wounded were carried down to the orlop. Yet the frigate's fire scarcely slackened from its first tremendous pace. Powder and shot ran smoothly up from the magazines. The gun teams rattled their massive pieces in and out with a magnificent zeal, sponging, loading, ramming, heaving up and firing with a racing coordination that it was a pleasure to watch. Although it was still impossible to see at all clearly, Jack was sure that they must already have mauled the Torgud very severely. She was certainly not firing so fast, nor from so many guns, and he was expecting her to wear in the smoke, either to run or to present her undamaged larboard broadside, when he heard the fierce, harsh trumpets bray out again. The Torgud was going to board.
"Grape!" he said to Pullings and his messengers, and very loud, "Sail trimmers, stand by!"
The Torgud's fire died away except for her bow guns. The smoke cleared, and there she was, turning into the wind, steering straight for the surprise, her bowsprit and even her jib boom crowded with people, willing to take the risk of a raking fire for the sake of boarding.
"Wait for it!"
cried Jack. To tack his ship before the Turk could run her aboard, to tack her in so short a space of time and sea as though she were a cutter, was appallingly dangerous. But he knew her through and through, and as he calculated the wind's strength, the ship's impetus, and the living force of the water, he called again,
"Wait for it! Wait! Fire!"
And then, the second his voice could be heard,
"Hands about, ship!"
The surprise came about, but only just. The Torgud did not. She lay there, taken aback. And as they passed, the surprises cheering like maniacs, Jack saw that the storm of grape had cleared her head of men. A most shocking butchery.
"Warm work, Professor,"
he said to Graham in the momentary pause.
"Is it indeed? This is my first naval battle of any consequence."
"Quite warm, I assure you. But the Turks cannot keep it up. That is the disadvantage of your brass guns. If you keep on firing at this rate, they melt. They are pretty, to be sure, but they cannot keep it up. Mr. Gill, we will lie on her larboard quarter, if you please, and rake her from there."
The Torgud, falling off, had put before the wind, and now the surprise bore up and made sail in pursuit. No guns but the bow chaser could be trained round far enough to bear, and all up and down the ship men straightened and stood easy. Some went to the scuttlebutts to drink or dash the water in their faces. Most were stripped to the waist, shining with sweat. All were in tearing spirits. At one of the quarterdeck carronades a young fellow was showing his mates a lost finger.
"I never noticed it," he kept saying. "Never noticed it go at all."
But now here, against all expectation, was the Katabi, coming up fast with the obvious intention of passing between the surprise and the Torgud, and then presumably of hauling her wind to take the surprise between two fires.
"That will not do, my friend," said Jack, watching her approach. "It is very gallant, but it really will not do. Round shot," he called, "and fire steady from forward aft. Fire at the word."
Some minutes later, when the relative positions of the three ships were such that the Torgud was directly to leeward of her consort, and unable to give her any support, Jack shivered the main and mizzen topsails, slanting down towards the Katabi, making no reply to her high, rapid, nervous, largely ineffectual fire, until they were a cable's length apart, no more. They gave her six deliberate, rolling broadsides, beating five of her midship's gun ports into one, and silencing her entirely. At the sixth there was a violent explosion aboard her, and the beginning of a fire. The surprise passed on, leaving her drifting before the wind, her people running with buckets and hose. The breeze had faded, perhaps stunned by the cannonade, and the surprise set her to gansels to pursue the Torgud. Not that the Turk was evidently flying, he had no great speed of canvas, but he was steering steadily on his original course, perhaps in the hope of reaching Ali Pasha. And right ahead the mainland could now be seen, mountain peaks nicking the horizon, while the low Morali Islands must be nearer still. In this wonderfully silent pause, while the boatswain and his mates sprang about the rigging, knotting and splicing, Jack stared at the Torgud for a moment, watching them throw their dead over the side, a trail of dead in her wake, and then made a quick tour of the ship. He found less damage than he had feared. One gun dismounted, the side pierced by 3 36-pounder balls, and some others, but none of the holes dangerously low, while in Stephen's hands there were no more than 6 badly wounded men, and 3 sewn into their hammocks. Remarkably few for such a furious bout. On deck again he saw that the breeze had recovered, and that the surprise was overhauling the Torgud fast. They were already within gunshot, but with land in sight it seemed to Jack that so long as he could avoid being boarded, close action was called for, and it was not until they were drawing abreast, close enough to see men's faces clearly, that he reduced sail and the hammering began again. This was the Torgud's larboard broadside, hitherto unengaged and undamaged, and the Turks blazed away with as much spirit as before. Again a 36-pound ball passed so close to Jack's head that it made him stagger. He actually saw the dark blur of its passing, and he said to driver of the marines,
"Let your men amidships concentrate on the loader of that damned heavy gun."
Graham, who was just at hand, said,
"May I take a musket, sir? I might do some good, and I feel uneasy, useless, and exposed standing here."
He was indeed exposed. Now that both ships had the wind aft, the smoke blew clear away forward. The Torgud was shooting more accurately than before, and as her shot hit the Surprise's bulwark or upper hull, so showers of splinters flew across her deck, some trifling, some deadly. Graham had already been knocked over twice, and most of those on deck had been more or less banged about. The Torgud was still full of fight, and she still had a surprising number of men. After a particularly violent salvo, she clapped her helm hard over, meaning to board again, and again her people crowded thick into her bows and along her bowsprit. This time the Surprise had no room to tack, but she had her forecourse in the brails for just such an emergency, and dropping it now, she shot ahead, though none too fast, since the Torgud's jib-boom caught in her mizzen-to-gallant backstays. She shot ahead nevertheless, her stern chasers blasting grape into the close-packed Turks, a red slaughter that checked even the gun crew's cheers. And the moment she had way enough, she crossed the Torgud's stern, raking her as she did so. The Surprise let fly her sheets, and the Torgud, ranging up, engaged again with her starboard broadside, shockingly ravaged from that first bout, with at least 7 guns dismounted, ports blackened and battered in, the scuppers and even the bare sides thick with blood. Ravaged, but still dangerous. Now, when some opponents might have struck, she let fly with 12 or 13 guns, and 2 of these did more damage than all she had fired hitherto. One struck the uppermost pintle and wedged the rudder, and another, the last of her huge round shot, caught the Surprise just as she was on the lift, showing her copper, and made a shocking great hole under her waterline. And a third, fired as Jack was giving Williamson orders to carry forward, took the boy's arm off at the elbow. Jack saw his amazed face go paper white, not pain, but amazement and concern and disbelief, whipped a handkerchief round the stump, twisted it tight, staunched the jetting blood, and passed him to a quartermaster to carry below. By the time the Surprise had dealt with the steering and the leak, the Torgud was much nearer the land. Apart from a few shots from her stern chasers as she drew ahead, she had not tried to profit by her advantage, still less to board. It was possible that she was unaware of the damage she had inflicted. It was certain that the last encounter, the last raking, had killed a great number of her men. She sailed away, therefore, and in her wake there now sailed the Katabi, she having pursued a course with no turnings since the Surprise left her, and both Turks were clearly steering for the same port.
"All sail she will bear, Mr. Puddings," said Jack,
going forward to study the Torgud through a borrowed telescope. A musket shot had broken his own as he held it. The tube shattered, his hand untouched. The Torgud had suffered terribly, there was no doubt of that. She was sailing low and heavy, and although the Surprise was now gathering way fast as Pullings spread to gansels and even weather stunsails in his passionate eagerness, the Torgud seemed unwilling and unable to make any increase, and even now the bodies were still splashing over the side.
"No,"
said Jack to Bondon at the starboard bow-chaser, as they came within easy range of the Turk's stern, moving faster every moment.
"Do not fire. We must not check her way. Boarding is the only thing for it, and the sooner the better."
"Anyhow, sir," said Bondon, "that damned fool is in the way."
This was the Katabi. Convinced that the Surprise was in pursuit of her, she had cracked on the most extraordinary amount of canvas to rejoin the Torgud, and now she lay directly between the two. Jack walked aft, and as he passed, the boarders in each gun crew smiled at him, or nodded, or said,
"Coming up now, sir,"
or cheerful words of that kind. And again he felt the rising of that enormous excitement of immediate battle, greater than any other he had ever known in the world. He spoke to the marines, who were now to come into their own, and after a few more turns he ran down the ladders to the lantern-lit orlop.
"Stephen," he said privately, "how is the boy?"
"He will do, I believe."
"I hope so, indeed. As soon as we come up, we mean to board."
They shook hands, and he ran on deck again. Pullings was already taking in the stunsails not to overrun the Torgood, and there, still absurdly ahead, fled the Kitabi between the two frigates. She fired not a gun. She seemed to have lost her head entirely.
"Forward there!" called Jack to the bow-chaser guns. "Send a ball over her deck!"
"By God!" cried the master as the Kitabi jigged at the shot. "She'll run the Torgood aboard if she don't take... By God, she can't avoid her! By God, she's doing it!"
With a rending, crashing sound that came clear to their ears at 400 yards, the Kitabi ground, slanting into the Torgood's starboard side, her foremast falling over the frigate's waist.
"Lay me athwart her stern," cried Jack,
and then, very loud,
"One broadside at the word, and board her in the smoke!"
As the Surprise began her turn, he stepped forward to the great gap in the starboard hammock netting torn by the Turks, loosening his sword, easing his pistols. Pullings was at his right hand, his eyes sparkling, and from nowhere had appeared the grim man Davis, jostling against Bondon on the left, looking perfectly mad, with a line of white spittle between his lips and a butcher's cleaver in his hand. The last sweeping movement, the easy, yielding crunch of the ship's sides, and the roar of the great guns as Jack gave the word. Then calling,
"Boarders away!"
he leapt through the smoke down to the Kitabi's deck. Perhaps 40 Turks stood against them, an irresolute line almost instantly overwhelmed and beaten back, and there in the clearing eddies was an officer holding out his sword, hilt first, and crying,
"Rendre! Rendre!"
"Mr. Gill, take charge,"
said Jack, and as the Torgut fired her remaining afterguns straight into the Kitabi, he raced through the billowing smoke into the bows, roaring,
"Come on, come on, come on with me!"
It was no great leap across, for the Torgood was low, low in the water, the sea washing into her shattered midship ports and flowing out red, and one flying stride took him onto her quarterdeck rail. Here it was different. Here, though her decks were bloody and ploughed with shot, they were still full of men. Most were facing aft into the smoke, but one whipped round and cut at him directly. Jack caught the blade on his sword, and from his height on the rail gave the Turk a great thrust with his foot that sent him flying into the waist of the ship, into the water that swilled over the waist of the settling, almost sinking ship. He leapt down onto the deck. He had never felt stronger or more lithe or more wholly in form, and when a pike came piercing through the confusion, thrusting straight at his belly, he slashed it with such force and precision that he struck the point clean from its shaft. Almost at once the fight took on a pattern. Jack, Pullings, and most of the boarders were crowding into the forward starboard corner of the Torgood's quarterdeck, trying to force their way aft from there and the gangway. Some others and all the marines were doing their best to storm the stern windows and the taffrail. It was the usual furious melee, with a huge amount of shouting and striving, very little room to move because of both friends and enemies, little in the way of skill in swordsmanship, an enormous pushing, thrusting, lashing out at a venture, quick stabs in the tumult, short-armed blows, kicking. The physical weight of both sides, and the moral weight of both sides. The mass heaved to and fro, turbans, skull-caps, yellow bloodshot eyes, swarthy bearded faces on the one hand, pale on the other. But both with the same extremity of naked, murderous violence— a prodigiously strenuous, vehement mass, sometimes clearing between the two fronts for a short burst of individual, direct and often deadly fighting. Then it closed again, the men face to face, even chest to chest, immediately touching, and hitherto neither had a clear advantage. Jack's 100 or so had won a few yards to fight in, but there they were blocked, and the people astern seemed to have lost their foothold. Jack had felt 2 or 3 wounds, the searing lash of a pistol ball across his ribs, a sword thrust, half parried on the other side, while once Davis had very nearly brought him down with the backstroke of his cleaver that opened a blunt gash on his forehead, and he knew that he had given some very shrewd blows. And all the time he looked for Mustafa, never a glimpse of him, though his enormous voice could be heard. Abruptly there was room in front of him, breathing space as some of the Turks eased back, still fighting. On Jack's right, Pullings lunged into this space, thrusting at his opponent, caught his foot on a ring bolt, and fell. For a fragment of time his ingenuous face was turned to Jack. Then the Turk's sword flashed down and the fight closed in again.
"No, no, no!"
roared Jack, driving forward with enormous strength. He had his heavy sabre in both hands, and taking no guard, he hacked and slashed, standing astride over Pullings's body. Now men scattered before his extreme fury. They fell back. The moral advantage was established. Shouting to Davis to stand by, to stand guard, to carry the body under the ladder, he charged aft, followed by all the rest. At the same time, the marines, repulsed from the stern and reformed farther forward, came thundering down both gangways with bayonets fixed. The crowd of Turks thinned, some running, most retreating steadily towards the taffrail, and there, abaft the tottering mizzen, sat Mustafa at a table covered with pistols, most of them discharged. His leg had been broken early in the day, and it rested on a blood-stained drum. Two of his officers were holding his hands down, and a third called to Jack,
"We surrender!"
This was Ulusan, who had come aboard the Surprise with Mustafa. He stepped forward, hauled down the colours, and slipped the ensign free. The others at last made Mustafa give up his sword. Ulusan, wrapping the flag about it, offered both to Jack in the unearthly silence. Mustafa rose up, grasping the table, and flung himself on the deck in a paroxysm of rage or grief, his head striking against the wood like a mallet. Jack glanced at him with frigid indifference.
"Give you joy, sir," said Mowat at his side. "You have come at the Nelson's Bridge at last."
Jack turned a pale, hard face on him.
"Have you seen Pullings?" he asked.
"Why, yes, sir," said Mowat, looking surprised. "They have fairly ruined his waistcoat and knocked his wits astray, but that don't depress his spirits, I find." "You had better get back to the barkey, sir," said Bondon, in a low voice, tucking the ensign and the other officer's swords under his arm. "This here is going to kingdom come."
This concludes the reading of The Ionian Mission by Patrick O'Brien. Copyright 1981 by Patrick O'Brien. This book was read by Simon Vance.